The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of our podcast. I'm Jessica Brown, linguistic editor at Culturico, and today I will be joined by co-host Federico Germani, also an editor here, and a very special guest, Dr. Ruth Vaden, as we talk and learn about the global inequality of COVID-19 vaccines. First, before we introduce our guest, I'd like to tell you a little bit about me and how I'm approaching this conversation. I am not a scientist or a political theorist or ethicist. I am a nature poet and a creative writing teacher, but I am keen to understand the situation we are in as a global community where there is an inequality of vaccines. I want to know how to read the situation, both immediate and longer term, and to think about how I can position myself ethically at this moment. You know, many of us in Western countries, rightly or wrongly, are starting to use language like post-vaccine, post-COVID, and I want to know how to think about and respond to this crisis of global inequality of vaccine access. Besides the pandemic itself, I am wondering if this inequality could very well be one of the more formative or destructive forces of our time. To try and understand the situation, Federico and I are very thankful to be able to host this incredible guest. Let me tell you about Dr. Vaden. Dr. Ruth Vaden is a professor of biomedical ethics at Johns Hopkins University. She is the founder of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and its director from 1995 until 2016. Her latest book with Madison Powers is Structural Injustice, Power, Advantage, and Human Rights. And finally, my co-host is Federico Germani, a bioethicist and molecular biologist at the University of Zurich. He is also the founder and director of Culturico. So welcome, Dr. Vaden and Fed.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hello from my side as well.
Hello. It's a privilege to have you both today. My questions are going to start large, almost asking to for a macro or aerial perspective on this situation, and hopefully to move to more granular, personal, and perhaps even actionable insights. Dr. Vaden, with something this scope and scale, which is, I mean, to my mind, when I try to figure it out, it's almost incomprehensible of where to begin. Where do you begin thinking about this problem? How do you find your way into it in order to begin to address it?
It's a very hard problem to get your head and heart around. And yet at the same time, it's basically straightforward. The dynamic we're in right now globally is essentially a special, compelling, heartbreaking, enormous version of what has been the background sort of truth about global justice pretty much always, which is that the countries of the world and the people living in them are positioned very differently, very, very differently in terms of access to power and advantage and everything that power and advantage can get you. In this particular case, the dramatic differentials in power and advantage have manifested in something super, super, super concrete, right? That there are many places in the world that have yet to see sizable numbers of vaccine, where in the United States, people are figuring out how to go on holiday now that everyone in their world has been vaccinated. This is really no different, though, in structure, Jessica, from the way in which the world is ordered more generally.
Yeah. Thank you. I want to, looking back, About this time last year, I think this is one of our worst fears, was something like this would happen and become almost a tale of two planets and really almost a tale of two timelines. And it seemed like COVAX was going to attempt to speak to this. What hasn't worked with, or why is that not working? Or do you think it is?
Well, let's turn this around.
Okay.
In the counterfactual world in which COVAX did not exist.
Yeah.
If we look historically at how vaccines in response to global pandemics were in fact allocated, we're actually, and I know this sounds really depressing, but we're actually ahead of the game.
Okay.
So if you think about H1N1, we were in far worse shape in terms of global inequities in access to flu vaccine. It just happened that the pandemic itself was not so severe.
Right.
Right. It turned out to be not as lethal, not as infectious a pathogen, right? COVAX has, in fact, significantly improved access to vaccine relative to historical experience.
Okay.
That's like the good news, right? The bad news, of course, is that COVAX, which has never previously, nothing like it has ever previously existed before,
yeah,
hasn't been able to make the kinds of dents, right, that had been hoped, at least not so far.
I'm going to ask just a couple of speculative questions, like as in I realize I'm asking you to speculate, but this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you and not just continue to read articles online of reporting. What do you think is, just to help us understand, what's one of the worst things that can come out of this inequality, as in put us on a timeline of like 50 years? Does it matter? Will it matter? Or is it like a 5-year thing? What kind of problem are we talking about? And is our way to avoid this, is our hope that COVAX will start to get more traction, become more effective? What do you think?
Well, it's more comforting to go to the second question than to go to the first. So it's not just COVAX.
Yeah.
Jessica, it's also the global response on the part of the G7, the G20, the IMF, the World Bank. Everyone is a bit late to the party, and I don't even like that reference because it makes too light of it. You know, basically we had a dynamic until now that continues, that the wealthy countries with advantage, basically, if you want a tortured metaphor, they went to the store, cleared off the shelves before the low and middle income countries ever had a chance to go shopping.
Yeah.
So take that image to your personal life and imagine that the wealthy have basically taken all the toilet paper and all the canned goods.
Yeah.
And then the rest of us are left trying to fend for ourselves in some context, in some doomsday scenario kind of a context. What has been happening just, I would say, recently is a broader recognition that this is just an unsustainable situation globally. You know, there are four sets of arguments that have been put forward for why wealthy countries have to behave differently than they have been behaving. There's the straight out ethics global equity argument, which is slam dunk, right? And I can go on that for the rest of the podcast, but I'm going to assume people don't need all of the dots filled in there. The problem is, of course, that those kinds of arguments are rarely compelling on their own. There's the pub, and this speaks to your first question too. Then there are the other three arguments that tend to be persuasive more often in a sort of geopolitical and national political context. The first, of course, is the public health concern to all of us. The standard line: no one is going to be really protected against the threat of COVID-19 and this pandemic until we get more or less global control. And I don't mean that we reach a level of herd immunity, but rather that we reach some level of global containment that makes sense. So there's the public health strategy and concern. There's the economic strategy and concern. And you've got lots of different entities who are making projections on return on investment, but basically somewhere in the order of $6 to $7 trillion will be lost if we don't do something over the next 18 months or so to the global economy. And most of that hit is going to come to high-income countries, if only because high-income countries make up most of the global economy, right?
Right.
And then the third set of arguments, actually have to do with international relations and geopolitics.
Okay.
Wealthy countries are trying to figure out, that is leadership of wealthy countries trying to figure out how not to lose the influence and the, and when, I don't want to use the word domination, but the sort of control over the global geopolitical world by ceding to China and Russia too much, right, of what sometimes is called vaccine diplomacy.
Yes.
So you've got three sets of arguments in addition to the overwhelming ethics and equity argument that are gaining traction. They're all good arguments. They all have, you know, sort of impeccable reasoning in many ways. And global leaders are responding. Well, enough in time. Those are the big questions.
Maybe if I can intervene, a follow-up question here would be, I mean, considering the anarchic structure of the international community, was there a possibility that we were not getting into this vaccine inequality situation? I mean, was there even hope for that, actually?
Well, it depends. I mean, Federico, you can hit me at a pessimistic moment, right? It depends, and depends on what you mean by equality, right? If we understood that what was required from the standpoint of just allocation of vaccines globally was a simple equality kind of thing, proportionate to the population coverage in countries, no, right? We have no structure. We have no way of doing that, right?
Yeah.
But even if you go to a more sophisticated understanding of what a just distribution would look like, the answer is still no. We have no global governance structure, right?
Right.
That would ever allow, right, for some sort of a mega process whereby the world would step back and develop a set of morally relevant, defensible criteria for how to allocate vaccine when it's in short supply, and then ensure that that's how, in fact, vaccine is allocated around the world. We are not set up for this, and we are not going to be set up for exactly this even afterwards, but we will get closer with each disaster. That's my optimistic thing. You know, I was mentioning earlier to Fred, to Jessica, that it is awful, but it's better than it was in terms of global access. And the hope is that post this pandemic, there will be enough structural changes that the next pandemic will not be as awful as this one in terms of global inequities. So that's kind of the trajectory. I think also in my more optimistic moments that the failures that we've seen here will not only, I hope, going forward, cause a reconsideration of how not to be in this situation again, specific to pandemics, but also may have implications for other collective action problems. Think, of course, climate change.
Yeah, makes sense.
Appreciate what you're saying. Yeah, I think that's kind of a nice way to pivot into thinking about what we can do. And I'm also going to ask a macro level and micro level. It's hard not to be overwhelmed at the big structures at work here, just as we've been saying, governments, politics, national vaccine diplomacy, infrastructures like building plants and securing raw materials, and then not to mention the tech giants and epidemic of misinformation. And Dr. Faden, is there any way for individuals wanting to be a global citizen during a global pandemic to have any interfacing with policymaking?
Of course there is. And I, of course there are. And I will run through a couple in just a moment. But I also think that we should be careful not to think that this is somehow a problem. This, how do we address globally? The pandemic is something, akin to a problem that we can shop our way out of, or
yeah,
even vote our way out of. It's that line that we often discuss in ethics between recognizing that there are real limitations on the consequences that flow from each individual person's action, and also, though, at the same time, recognizing that in the absence of individual action, we will see no traction, right?
Yes.
So let me be referential for a moment to the U.S. And then speak to people listening to this podcast who are not Americans. And I will be blatantly, I think, political with a small p and a big P here. A huge step happened when Americans voted out the Trump administration and voted in the Biden administration. So that there right, was an action step that individuals took in a country that is having real implications for how, in the immediate shift of administration, this problem of global inequities and access to vaccine is being addressed.
Yes.
I don't want to suggest that what the Biden administration is doing is sufficient, but it's unimaginable that the Trump administration would have done anything like this. Okay.
Okay.
So right there, people around the world can be thinking about, especially people living in wealthy and advantaged countries, about the positions of the political parties that are in charge and whether to what extent there are differences around commitments to global responsibility that might influence how you proceed if you live in a country where your vote matters, which is not everywhere, right?
Yes.
So there's that. And I don't want to suggest that Americans voted, right, for a change of administration because they wanted
right.
global allocation fair. But it kind of went with the package, right? It kind of went with the package. It was to be predicted. So there's that. There are also opportunities as individuals to contribute to all kinds of organizations, including to the WHO and COVAX itself, right? And I mean now financially. And while I, you know, we're talking about shortfalls and, you know, or sort of needs in the order from, I don't know, you know, $30 to $50 billion has been projected in terms of funding requirements for low and middle income countries over the next 2 years. So you might think that your $10, your $50, your $1,000, how far does that go? But it is an incredible morale boost. And it also is an incredible statement. And, you know, it's like any other campaign. It adds. I also think that helping to think my third territory in space is that there is this challenge, and it is a real ethics challenge about priorities and obligations within one's own country and globally. The more that individuals in wealthy and privileged countries educate themselves about where there is alignment and where there are trade-offs and have conversations with neighbors and friends and coworkers that can push the general discussion away from a stark sense of us or them. Why should we give our vaccines away in, right? Till we're all protected here. I think that matters. I think that matters because politicians respond, political leaders respond not only to obviously the need to be reelected in countries where that matters, but also to just popularity in what they perceive to be the will of the communities, the constituents that they serve.
Thank you. I think that's a really empowering answer. And it kind of speaks to, I've heard of these, or certainly, you know, these initiatives like go give one and get a vaccine, give a vaccine. I think it's a morale boost to the people who are campaigning, you know, the ones running the initiative. I also think it's a morale boost to people who are participating in it. I think it's so worthwhile to have that narrative of we're in this together as much as we can, and not just, like I said, kind of diverge into a tale of two planets, two timelines. Though of course that it's only emphasizing what has been the story all along. And that's one, it's kind of a philosophical question at the end. You've already spoken to it a little bit, but I wonder what you think here. You know, securing global vaccine equality could come from a place of care and altruism, or it could also come from a place of realizing that future precarity could be solved by vaccinating globally as swiftly as we can. Do you think either of these are effective in changing this scenario, or do you think we're going to just try to do what has kind of worked before and live with even less porousness between richer, wealthier, and poorer countries?
So I just a point of clarification, Jessica, we want to, and I know this sounds like a sort of nerdy point, but we want to talk about global equity and not global equality, right? Equality carries with it a notion that the most just way is always to divide things up equally.
Right.
And that may not be what's required here. But in terms of global equity, I'm a pragmatist with respect to what arguments to use. I use every argument that can possibly persuade anybody to move on this issue, as long as that argument is defensible.
Yes.
So I think that as I mentioned earlier, I don't think that the arguments that are grounded in what is the correct position from the standpoint of global justice by themselves are sufficient to move to where we need to go as a pragmatic reality. But if you don't make them, you also lose some of the power of what's at issue. People like to be seen as doing the right thing. But often that's not sufficient motivation, right, to actually do the right thing.
Yeah.
In this case, we really have an over-determined situation. It just makes so much sense, whether you think about what is the just way to proceed as a global community, whether you think about it in terms of protecting the health of your own people, you think about it in terms of economic national self-interest, or you think of it in terms of geopolitical national interest. It all comes together. So it's a case of structuring a path forward, right, that political leaders can pursue while at the same time maintaining their power and control within their own countries. That's basically what this is about. So when countries in the global south or organizations like the WHO try to, encourage or otherwise just condemn the way countries like the U.S. are proceeding to vaccinate through to children as young as 12, when countries in in low-income parts of the world are barely approximating covering their highest risk people, you can make that case, but you have to recognize that, is it plausible for a political leader in a country in which they need to get reelected to be able to say no to families who are struggling desperately because their children are doing so poorly, their adolescents? I mean, it's just a very difficult dynamic.
I loved your nerdy point as well. I really like using, as a creative writing teacher, as a poet, using the right words is good. So I'm going to take that, talking about global equity. And speaking of that, so I think we're going to wrap up our conversation pretty soon. I have one last question, Dr. Faden. Fed, what about you? Any last thoughts or questions?
I was thinking about something provocative, actually. I mean, Dr. Faden, you just mentioned that basically democratic processes are somewhat interfering with equal distribution of vaccines, if I read or understand correctly. So I want to ask something provocative. Does this make sense, what I just said? And is there any sort of way, political way, to improve the situation? Maybe not in this case, but for the future.
Yeah, I want to be careful, Federico. I don't know that democratic processes are any worse for the global equity challenge that we're failing to meet than, say, autocratic processes. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't see a greater will to share vaccines or to allocate resources from countries that have distinctly illiberal governance structures. And also at the same time, we know, there's so much evidence and indication that the country's self-labeling of its governance structure does not necessarily match how indeed the country is governed. Right.
Right.
But I am saying that in countries where there is some accountability at the ballot box, it is complicating, right?
Yes.
It is complicating. And I also do want to emphasize that even from a human rights perspective, we have a flawed global system generally. And then in that flawed global system, the first guarantor of human rights falls to the countries in which people live, right? And that's, of course, a disaster for many, many people who live in countries who either cannot or will not protect and advance their human rights claims. But what it does is it takes countries who are more or less sort of legitimate and say, look, our first obligations are to our own citizens. I mean, I would hope they would say residents, but it's often their own citizens. And that's not debatable in the current global order.
Right.
Yeah.
So the problem, and I was saying earlier, we can end where we began. This is just a special, horrible instance of a generalized problem, which is that we do not have a mechanism for achieving just access to many things that are necessary for a decent life, including life itself. So much as we've often said, we don't have a supply problem with food. We have a distribution problem with food. And that is what explains famine and undernutrition, not the fact that the planet is, at least right now, failing to produce enough food.
Yeah.
The same is true with vaccine. Now, here we have had a supply problem in the beginning. The supply problem, especially with products like Novavax coming online, over the next year or so, we will have less of, you know, the supply constraint will be here, but the bigger problem will continue to be who controls the supply and who determines who gets the supplies when.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my very last question here is, Dr. Faden, do you have one idea or question or action for our listeners to take away from the conversation?
Well, I guess it's a plea, and it is a plea to now more than ever think of yourselves as global citizens, as well as residents and citizens of whatever country you live in. And with that identity in your hearts, right, as well as your heads, look to local action and personal responsibility as much as you can.
Local action and personal responsibility. A plea for that. I thank you so much, Dr. Faden. It's been such a privilege to have your expertise and your compassionate perspective and your passion with us for this podcast. Thank you.
Well, I'm very much delighted. And thank you both for the good questions.
Thank you. Take care. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Culturico was produced by Jessica Brown and Federico Germani. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at culturico.com. If you want to get our latest episodes, subscribe to Culturico on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.